Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Forest ecologists estimate more than 5 billion birds migrate to or through the boreal forest each year. That's a lot of biomass that depends on the existence of viable habitat in our forests. Making sure it lasts has been the focus of research for the Sustainable Forest Management Network over the last 12 years. The scientists, companies, and governments involved in the network met in Edmonton recently to discuss their findings and what these mean for how we will manage our forests in the future. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The Sustainable Forest Management Network is one of the most successful organizations under the Networks of Centers of Excellence program funded by the Canadian government. In June, network researchers gathered in Edmonton for their fourth international conference. This was an opportunity for these scientists to not only showcase the results of their research, but also how it's being implemented by forest companies and the various governments that are partners in the network. Dr. Jim Files is a professor of forest ecology at McGill University, and he is also the scientific director for the Sustainable Forest Management Network.
Well, it's a good demonstration of the success of the network. We're still around. If you look at the way that networks of centers of excellence work, we get reviewed every 3 years, and so we've had we've just finished our third review, and we're having our fourth conference, and that's a good testimony to our success at survival in any case. And our history is based on evaluation of our impact on Canadian society and the forest management across the country and our impact on research. So I think that comes through in this conference.
Do you have any indication over the years how many research projects have gone through the network?
Somewhere on the order of 450, I would say. The last time we really counted up was 350, and that was a couple of years ago, so I would say about 450.
I've been to every Sustainable Forest Management Network conference that there's been since they started, and one of the things I've always enjoyed is hearing the results of all the different research projects that are going on. But what I've really noticed about this conference is that there's a real emphasis on implementation or integration into the logging operations for the forestry companies to actually start using this. What is the status of that?
This is an initiative that has been in the network to some extent for a long time, but really 2 years ago got a big impetus by putting a large budget into our knowledge exchange program. And the focus of that really it was to ensure that the results of the academic research were translated to make them into a language and a format that was usable by the people that were either working in the forest on the ground, doing forest planning or forest operations, or also working in government designing policy. So this is and it's very gratifying to see how much focus there is on implementation at this conference, because that's something that we've been working hard on. Researchers are not necessarily trained to be involved in that, nor are they necessarily rewarded by their own organizations, their own institutions for doing that kind of work. And so it requires a certain amount of discussion amongst the network partners and researchers to make that happen. But we're very pleased that it's starting to bear fruit.
Could you give a couple of examples where work done by the Sustainable Forest Management Network has really made a difference?
The one that really stands out in Alberta is, in fact, the new forest management planning standard that has been developed by the Department of Sustainable Resource Development, I think it's called. And it's very gratifying to us because they themselves, the policymakers themselves, will say, yes, we looked through and made good use of SFM network research to put into that planning standard. Across the country, network researchers were very involved in Quebec in the Coulomb Commission that recommended very sweeping changes to forest policies in Quebec. There's also several or many examples of companies, for instance, Alpac, Louisiana Pacific, that have been very active in the network and made a very active use of network research in their own planning and operations.
The network is all about partnerships and collaboration. Do you see any gaps still? Are there still some other groups that you're trying to bring in?
The network is really focused on the forest and the forest sector from the beginning. That was its genesis from those kinds of partnerships. And over the last couple of years, we've really worked to strengthen those partnerships. But in the same time, the research that we're doing and the other research in other places have really identified the need to look at the whole of the forested landscape and all of the players on that forested landscape, not just at the forest industry. And in Alberta, for instance, oil and gas is a very significant, the energy industry is a very significant player on the landscape, and it doesn't make sense to focus on the forest companies in terms of managing the forest. We could do a brilliant job of managing the forest through the forest companies and still be not effective because there's so much activity from the energy sector in the landscape. So it's very important to now reach out toward those folk and engage them in the discussion of what the ideas about sustainable management of the landscape as a whole should be. And on the other hand, there are other groups, non-governmental organizations, the certification organizations, environmental groups that would be very valuable to have at the table because of the perspectives on sustainability that they would bring.
Just getting back to oil and gas, what can you do to bring them to the table?
Well, that's a good question. I often hear that the oil and gas industry is just pretty well used to doing whatever they want. But nevertheless, I think that some issues are raising that when there was an impression that the landscape was sort of empty, you could go out and do more or less whatever you wanted in the landscape. But it's very clear that it's not empty anymore. It's getting full of activity. And so they are already sensitive to the environmental impact of their operations. They're very sensitive to the impact of oil and gas exploration on caribou, for instance, and very sensitive to their impact on hydrology and water table depths and those kinds of things. And there are many issues that are still unknown around those, and so there are research activities that need to be done. So it certainly they're interested, and we've been talking to the energy industry already, and they may well come around our table in a very short period of time.
What's next for the network?
Well, that's a very good question. The way the networks of centers of excellence works is that there's a maximum time period for that sort of funding from the federal government of 14 years. Right now we're just starting year 12, and so we have a couple of years of that sort of funding left. And it's a very, very active discussion among the partners. Going back now a year and a half, since we really started to try to get this discussion going about what happens after year 14. And it's been an interesting development because it's the kind of issue that, you know, it's something that's in the future. We don't have to worry about that too much. So people weren't really thinking about it. And over the last year, people have really started to focus. Our partners in government and in industry have really started to focus on, okay, well, here this network may be coming to an end, and so we need to be thinking about what to do next. And at this point, I'm very optimistic that the partners will come together and define or support a research network that does the same kind of work that we do in a lot of the same ways that we do it, and to provide this kind of a research service to Canadian society in the future.
It's a great network. It's a great conference. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jim Files, Scientific Director of the Sustainable Forest Management Network. He is also a professor of forest ecology at McGill University in Montreal. The Alberta forest landscape is the busiest forest in Canada. Along with logging operations, their seismic and drilling activity, road building, utility corridors, recreational use, and encroachment from real estate development. And somehow, the plants and the animals are supposed to live there, too. Dr. Vic Adamovich is a professor of rural economy at the University of Alberta. At the recent conference hosted by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, he presented his research on the trade-offs we'll have to make between forestry and energy development versus environmental sustainability.
What our research is looking at is not necessarily the conflict between forestry and oil and gas. What we're looking at is the trade-off between economic development or development opportunities and different notions of biodiversity or biodiversity conservation, either fine filter or coarse filter. So the reason that we're looking at both the energy sector and forestry is that, of course, they're both economic development agents on the landscape, often on the same land bases, and they will together have some impact on our various measures of biodiversity. And we're trying to better isolate what those trade-offs might be if we, for example, put in targets or minimum levels of habitat loss as a biodiversity conservation goal, what would the impact be on economic development for both forestry and the energy sector, to better understand what those impacts really are.
How do you get at that?
Well, there are two things that we're doing. What we've got completed to this point is actually modeling individual forestry firms across the region of northern Alberta and northeastern British Columbia to understand how they would respond to different policy targets, and then understand how they would be affected, their profitability, the economic consequences of that, the employment patterns perhaps within regional economies. So what would the trade-offs be? Would there be significant, say, losses in economic activity, or minor across a range of different policy objectives? So this is not saying where we should be. This is just saying what would the consequences be of setting different biodiversity targets. We've got that now running for the forestry sector, and we're working on integrating the energy sector in the same way. So we could say those two major sectors in northern Alberta and northeast British Columbia, how would they be affected by trying to meet these various biodiversity targets?
What are some of the things that you're finding out?
Well, right now, some of these results are still preliminary, but we're finding that for the forestry sector, the initial impacts of trying to achieve biodiversity targets in a coarse filter sense, which right now we're modeling as old mesic forest or percent of old growth forest in the boreal, the consequences are relatively small initially, and we could probably do a lot in a sense for a while, and then they become much more severe as we work our way down. We're also trying to better understand whether fine filter targets, in our case bird species across the boreal, whether those would track along with our coarse filter targets, so whether we'd achieve various biodiversity objectives with the same kind of biodiversity policy or target. We're also finding that at the scale we're working at, the place we're at currently seems to be within the range of natural variation for our coarse filter indicator, which is a good story at that scale. And so we're wondering what the implications will be as we think about smaller scales and attempting to reach those same ecological objectives at smaller scales. Will we also be in that same range of a good news story or not?
Well, from an environmental perspective, when you look at the results of this development in the north, forestry, you cut down the trees, but right away you can see them coming back again. When you're looking at something like mining for oil sands, not only are the trees gone, but the ground that they grow on, and we're not going to see those come back in our own lifetime. So how do you get an equivalent of trade-offs?
That's right. Well, actually, two points about that. One point is that our current work is only looking at conventional oil and gas development, and that's the only sector that we're modeling. So we're not doing anything with oil sands or some of the other developments along those lines, nor coal bed methane at this point, although at some point we'd like to get into those areas as well. But that's one of the reasons we've taken such a large geographic perspective on this. So all of northern Alberta and British Columbia. So at that very large scale, what are the trade-offs? Clearly, at smaller scales, oil sands developments, we can't have those same kinds of evaluations. They'll be quite different because of the scale. But we're looking at this at a very broad scale, saying at a bioregional level, what could we accomplish? And what would be perhaps the least cost way of achieving some environmental objectives at that scale? As we move to smaller scales, we'll have different trade-offs that we'll have to make.
Now, some of the terms that you've brought up are things like permanent reserves, dynamic habitat protection within the industrial landscape. What do those things mean?
Well, I think we have a number of different options that we could think of to achieve environmental goals. And what we'd like to do is evaluate those different options to see how effective they are in a trade-off with industrial development. If we could achieve the same environmental goal with a floating reserve or a fixed reserve strategy, which one would be lower cost? So what would be the best outcome in terms of both environmental and economic objectives? And that's really what we're trying to do, is trying to get a better handle on what are the costs of achieving environmental objectives, what are the least cost approaches to achieving those objectives, and then leaving for a broader discussion, where should we be in terms of what stringency of environmental objectives?
Once you finish up this work, what happens to it?
Well, we're hoping actually to build and expand on this work. As I say, in a research sense, we currently have the forestry sector that we've incorporated in our modeling activities. We're working hard to incorporate energy sector more completely. It right now is in the model only as an agent affecting land use patterns, but we don't have the economic consequences developed fully. We would certainly like this to be one of the suite of tools that's used in public policy analysis. That's our objective, is to say, here is a piece of information that we hope is useful. If we understand the trade-offs between achieving environmental objectives and economic consequences, that might help us better identify land use planning strategies or objectives for biodiversity conservation, or indeed strategies that we could use to achieve environmental goals at lower costs.
At what point, then, do the costs kind of outweigh the benefits? At what point do we say the environment is not going to make it through this development?
That's not really a question we're answering. Let me frame it this way. We're at this point only describing what the cost trade-offs are with biodiversity conservation, and we're leaving it for, let's say, a future phase or other forums to discuss where we might be. At what point are the costs too much, saying this biodiversity standard is too strict, we can't afford that in some way. We just want to provide good scientific information, ecological and economic information, so that we can then assess those trade-offs and have that informed debate. What we're also doing is investigating how within sectors there are policy changes that might actually make it cheaper to achieve environmental goals. So within the forestry sector, are there things that we could do to streamline the process, if you like, and actually achieve environmental goals at lower costs, and a kind of win-win outcome for both the economic and the environmental sides of the coin? That's a very important part of what we're trying to model to better understand how we could achieve these indirect approaches to environmental quality and economic outcomes.
What role, then, does the Sustainable Forest Management Network play in helping take that forward?
I think there are two issues. SFM's been a wonderful place to do this kind of work because it supported the interdisciplinary research, the long time scale research, and the funding requirements for this kind of work. And we've worked in consultation with our partners. Our partners in the forest industry and government have been, I would say, very influential in what we've done. And I'd like to think that they feel we've been responsive to their questions and concerns. And that's a great way to do this kind of work. SFM's a wonderful place to do that work, and it sponsors it. I think SFM now can help us with extensions of this work, helping us interface with the policy community, helping us extend our work, better understand the work that's going on. And again, the resources are here within the network to try to do that work.
Thank you very much, Vic.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Vic Adamovich, a professor of rural economy at the University of Alberta, and a researcher with the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Every spring, hundreds of species of birds and waterfowl migrate north to nest in Canada's boreal forest. One scientist concerned with sustaining their ecological habitat is Dr. Samantha Song. Samantha is a boreal ecologist with the Canadian Wildlife Service, and she's the coordinator of the Western Boreal Conservation Initiative. I spoke with Samantha after her presentation at the Sustainable Forest Management Network Conference in Edmonton.
This program is an effort by Environment Canada to bring some federal presence to biodiversity conservation efforts in boreal forests and to do it on a partnership basis.
Who are your partners?
We have a huge range of partners. We're a fairly young program. We're just 3 years old, but we've managed to partner quite broadly, federal, provincial, territorial governments, Aboriginal organizations and governments, research institutions, industry, of course, the private sector, both the energy and forestry sector.
What is it that you've accomplished so far?
Actually, the partnerships are a big accomplishment in terms of engaging and having that discussion, but the big focus has been around improving the knowledge base that we can make decisions from. So how do we manage such a vast system? I mean, we all know the boreal is huge. We know we don't know very much about it. So how do we go about developing that knowledge base? And we have focused quite strongly on the migratory bird component, partially because we have a mandate there, but also because that we see birds as potential indicators of forest condition and an area where we have existing capacity and can contribute very effectively.
Well, let's talk about birds for a minute. How many birds or how many different species actually use the boreal forest?
Breeding-wise, 325 species have their core breeding habitat within the boreal forest. And there are more species, the number I don't have off the top of my head, that do either migrate through the forest or depend on the forest in some ways. And the numbers that came from a recent report by Peter Blanchard from the Canadian Wildlife Service and with Bird Studies Canada was around 3 to 5 billion birds.
Billion birds.
Billion, yes, land birds that are breeding there. And if we start expanding it out from land birds, the little, dicky birds, we start talking about ducks, then we have, 12 to 15 million water birds and waterfowl. Shorebirds, a little bit trickier to know, but we know there's quite a number there as well.
Now, as part of the presentation about the program today, there were some results from different research projects, which also revolve around birds that were given. Could you outline some of the initiatives there on the research projects?
Yeah, we're engaging in a range of studies that look at the impacts of industrial activity on migratory birds and looking at how we can develop best practices there. So, for example, today we saw Steve Van Wilgenberg, who's been talking about comparing natural disturbance, which is an analog for harvesting, and looking at how we modify harvesting practices there and how does that work how does that influence migratory birds. So, for example, he was looking specifically at a single pass harvesting, which would emulate the activity of a fire, just going through once, get in, get out. And he was showing some differences, not as huge differences as you might have hoped, between a single pass and the traditional two pass, where you're coming into a system a couple times to harvest. I was showing some differences there that it's not exactly the same as a harvest, particularly immediately after a disturbance when the communities are quite distinct. But over the longer term, we certainly saw that there was enough difference that might be accentuated over time, so that even though single pass and two pass systems of harvesting might not be that different immediately, in the longer term, the single pass technique probably would provide more ecological habitat for birds.
So actually, then, in a single pass, the cut blocks would be much larger than the way they are now?
Yes, they are much larger. Right now, with a two-pass system that some companies use, cut blocks might be 60 hectares, 25 hectares on average, and a single-pass system, they would be substantially larger than that, for example, up to maybe even 1,000 hectares or larger.
One of the other issues that constantly comes up is all the different things that are happening on the land base, and so you have these cumulative effects of different human activities. What's happening from a research point of view for your project?
We have a study with Ducks Unlimited and industrial partners Alberta Pacific and Louisiana Pacific, and also with the University of Alberta, who are looking at varying levels of harvesting and linear disturbance and all the various activities of the landscape, and looking at how, as you increase that amount of disturbance over time, how does that affect those communities. But certainly you start to see substantial effects on bird communities, especially as you start to lose the forest cover, that you see substantial changes in those populations.
And it's not just forestry, it's also agriculture, isn't it?
Yes, certainly agriculture, oil and gas, and a whole range of activities out there.
What role, then, does the Sustainable Forest Management Network play in the work that you're doing through Environment Canada?
The Sustainable Forest Management Network has really been a phenomenal partner for us. There's a lot of aspects of biodiversity conservation that aren't just about birds, obviously, and the Sustainable Forest Management Network is a way for us to increase our capacity and to address some of those factors that we wouldn't be able to do on our own. So sustainable forest management, you think of ecological, economic, and social sustainability, all those elements. And so we've been able to partner with a range of researchers on social sustainability, on economic incentives for biodiversity conservation, the effect of conservation policies on the competitiveness of Canada's forest industry. How do we go about managing the landscape in an integrated fashion? So how do we get all these agencies to talk to each other and coordinate management? What are the governance models for that? And as much as we want to build on our capacity internally and use them for our staff, there are some things that we are unlikely to have substantial capacity on, and the Sustainable Forest Management Network has been great at providing that. And I'll just say as well, although I'm very excited about these social and economic issues as well, we've also partnered with them around ecological issues as well, and they've helped us leverage our efforts significantly there.
Thank you very much, Samantha.
Thanks, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Samantha Song, a boreal ecologist with the Canadian Wildlife Service and coordinator of the Western Boreal Conservation Initiative. She was a presenter at the recent Sustainable Forest Management Network conference in Edmonton. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, Alberta Innovation and Science, iCORE, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, Calgary Technologies Inc., Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Science Alberta Foundation, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Crocher.